Paul Mosher, welcome to the KBOX Heart of the Arts.
Thank you, Robert.
There are a lot of people who go to university, decide they want to be a writer, like right off the bat. They join a creative writing program and they just plug away at writing a novel their entire lives until they get famous or they give up. But you seem to have discovered and really hit pay dirt creative writing fairly far along, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I've written my whole life, but for a long time it was only journals. Back in the 90s, I used to write short stories and send them to the types of publications that would pay you in copies, and they always said, well, you know, not quite right or whatever. I was always a one-draft kind of guy because I had a Smith Corona. It was difficult to do anything more than one draft. It wasn't always my dream to be a novelist, and I thought that it was outside of my ability just because I've got kind of a chaotic head. It's a sort of thing that's difficult to do until you see yourself doing it.
What's significant about this publication is that this is you've earned the attention of a serious New York publisher, and that this isn't a small press. This is a pretty big deal. How did this come about?
This amazing agent, Wendy Schmaltz, and then HarperCollins bought it in what's called a preempt, where they make a generous offer to keep it from going to auction. And so then I, you know, now I have an editor at HarperCollins that is working with me, and it's a two-book deal, so we've put to bed The Train I Ride, so that's going to be out in January. It's been really fascinating to me to see how a book comes about, and then all the hands that are involved and how many hours they spend on it, and it really feels great.
This is one of those milestones that every author dreams of. Do you feel different as a writer, like when you go back to a keyboard? Do you feel bolstered by it, or is it just sort of like, let's tell another great story?
Sometimes I just can't believe, like, when the book became available, even though you can order it, it won't be delivered until January, and I did just so that I could click purchase and not then wake up from a dream. My wife used to, like, catch me working on a novel in the middle of the day at a coffee house and say, aren't you supposed to be working? And I'd be like, this is work. And now if she sees me doing that, she has to say, that better be a novel that you're writing. That better be something marketable or something with an audience, not one of those
that
crazy
better
ones
be that, a novel you're writing.
Right. That's it feels really, so that feel I feel really lucky.
So let's start with this book. It's coming out in January of 2017, right? Could you tell us about it?
It's January 24th is the release date. So it's called Train I Ride, which is about a girl who turns 13 while riding a train from Los Angeles to Chicago, Amtrak. And she's got nobody in the world aside from the strangers that she comes to meet on the train. And so it's considered middle grade. That's the publishing group that I've got a contract with. I did not know it was middle grade when I wrote it, and it's intended to be enjoyed by people of all ages. But that's the age of the protagonist, and the lack of cussing and other elements makes it considered middle grade.
Part of what I enjoy about the concept is I've been lifelong fanatical about trains. How did you pick that as opposed to a more contemporary, you know, a car or a Greyhound or any number of other ways to get across the country?
Well, I too love trains. I did not know that about you. I've never been upset having to wait for it. You know, if I'm going to be made late for any reason, it's, you know, waiting for a freight train to pass is as good of a reason as any in my book. I've actually, when I was a kid, I remember one time for my birthday, my wish was to go down to the train tracks and look at the trains. That was when Phoenix had an Amtrak station downtown at Union Station. But we had taken a train trip the previous summer ourselves from Flagstaff to Chicago, my wife and two daughters. We went there and back, and it's not our story, but it was certainly the story idea came to me from the Elvis Presley and Junior Parker lyric "Train I Ride 16 Coaches Long," and I thought, oh, that sounds like a good opening line for a novel. And then I just wondered who said the line. Is it a boy or a girl, a man or a woman? Why are they on the train? Where are they going? And that kind of thing.
So you didn't necessarily set out to write a YA novel.
Correct. Yeah, and again, it's middle grade, which, like, there's a million Google entries trying to illustrate the distinction between YA and middle grade. But when you pick up YA, they tend to be chiefly about romance, whereas like middle grade, puppy love is the furthest you can go. There tends to be plenty of cussing in YA, and they struck the two cuss words that appeared in Train I Ride originally. I think that I wrote it the way that I would write the first two novels that I wrote were strictly for grown-ups, and the third one I wrote was intended for my older daughter to read. It was delivered to a proof copy delivered to our hotel on her 11th birthday. Mm. That was a book called Story Girl. And so, and then I found that writing for that age group could be, you know, you could have the sort of emotional depth that would be required for me to feel like I'd done something really cool or something that was really moving to me and felt really, you know, it was great to be along for the ride for. I didn't set out to write a book for that age. That's just and I intend for it to be enjoyed by people of all ages, but that's just sort of who the character that was presented to me was. So she determined that.
So who is your character? Who is this protagonist?
It's a girl who she turns 13 while riding on the train, but she's her name is sort of hinted at. It's never her given name. She adopts the name Ryder, when somebody mistakes her name, it makes the mistake of her name being Ryder because of a lanyard around her neck that says Ryder, and then her last name, which was my fictional way of Amtrak employees being able to keep track of her as being an unaccompanied minor, even though she's got an Amtrak employee chaperone. And so when somebody makes the mistake of her name as being Ryder, she goes with it because she's really anxious to leave her past behind her. And then she further alters the spelling of her name to R-Y-D-R after she gets a hold of the book Howl, the poem and collection of poems Howl by Allen Ginsberg, because of his propensity to take shortcuts with the spelling of words. So, the book Howl sort of helps her find her voice, and she feels like it was written for her. And I'm really happy that I get to make a book that is, in part an homage to Howl, and that it gets to be disseminated to middle grade readers. That just really tickles me that I am getting away with that.
Now, you have two daughters, right?
Yes, 12-year-old and 7-year-old.
Do you find that there's any crossover between this fictional character you've created and your actual children?
I don't know. Maybe at times the voice. She's certainly got different circumstances. There's other things that I've written, like the more recent, the story Echo's Sister, which is very much based on our experiences, although it's not our family, strictly speaking. But I think that maybe the voice, but Ryder has had a much more difficult life than my children have had, or that you would wish upon any children. So she's a, but maybe what I wish for my daughters is what I inflict upon my protagonists in terms of their being strong and the sort of, I love spending time with both of my daughters, sometimes I've had other writers say, kids don't listen to music this good, or they're not this smart. And I'm like, sometimes they are. And I want to draw a protagonist that is the kind of person that I like to spend time with, because, they do exist, and it's nice. It's more enjoyable that way, for sure.
Now, there are a lot of people who like go to university, decide they want to be a writer, like right off the bat. They join a creative writing program and they just plug away at writing a novel their entire lives until they get famous or they give up. But you seem to have discovered and really hit pay dirt creative writing fairly far along. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've written my whole life, but for a long time it was only journals. Back in the 90s, I used to write short stories and send them to the types of publications that would pay you in copies. And they always said, not quite right or whatever. I was always a one draft kind of guy because I had a Smith Corona. It was difficult to do anything more than one draft, but I've always, I think writing well has always come easily to me, and so I never really learned until late in life, well, you know, comparatively late, how I could write with difficulty and also having the resources like, you know, the writers groups that I've met you at, where sitting, you know, I go two or three nights a week and bring the words that I've written in the past, you know, few days and get suggestions from other writers, take some of them and leave others. And it's, you know, having that has helped me, you know, become better at what I'm trying to do. But I've never been a huge reader. When I read, I try to read really well. It wasn't always my dream to be a novelist, and I thought that it was outside of my ability just because I've got kind of a chaotic head. But I think that it's a sort of thing that's difficult to do until you see yourself doing it, and then it gets easier to imagine yourself doing it. Now, you know, I've completed five, and I've half completed four others, that some of which will probably be completed.
Five novels,
someday.
You mean?
Yeah, and I'm and now, so now I feel like I can look, like an idea can come to me, you know, and I will pretty much immediately be able to say with, you know, feeling certain whether or not I can develop it into a, you know, full length novel idea. Like, yeah, that's got, you know, dreaming room adequate to, you know, support a novel. I used to make half of my living as a painter, and I would look at the world like, this is a suitable subject for a painting, this is not a suitable subject for a painting. And now I sort of sift through my experience with, like, everything is sorted through the, you know, suitable for a novel filter. And then sometimes it's like, wow, no, this is not an idea that for a novel, but this is an idea that can be included in a novel, like having a character who draws a graphic novel where nobody has hands, for instance.
Right. Now, what's curious, what's significant about this publication is that this is you've earned the attention of a serious New York publisher, and that this isn't a small press. This is a pretty big deal. How did this come about?
Yeah, I feel really, really fortunate for, and I think that, you know, I've said, and I said before this happened, that, you know, writing ought to be worth doing for its own sake. And aside from the poets that I'm friends with that are, you know, that have no hope whatsoever of ever making a living at it, I mean, it's like we ought to be writing because it's an amazing experience. It's like having children to give birth to a novel. And if we're doing it as a get-rich scheme, then we're fools. But it was my fourth novel that earned me an agent. I got this amazing agent, Wendy Schmaltz, and then she found, you know, two of the four majors that she sent the manuscript to ended up wanting it, and so HarperCollins bought it in what's called a preempt, where they make a generous offer to keep it from going to auction, and so then I, you know, now I have an editor at HarperCollins that is working with me, and it's a two-book deal, so we've put to bed The Train I Ride, even though a novel in the traditional world has an incredibly long gestation period when you're accustomed to doing it yourself, but it's certainly worth it. So that's going to be out in January, even though I was done writing it May of last year, and then we edited it in winter of this past winter, and meanwhile, like, the marketing people and the cover illustration people and the typographer and all these other people, legal people, they just asked me again today whether this book that book within a book is a book that actually exists, and the answer again was no, it's a fake book called the I can't remember the name of it, but I wrote a few verses of it for, it's like a children's book within a book that, it's interesting. It's been really fascinating to me to see how a book comes about, and then all the hands that are involved and how many hours they spend on it. And it really feels great. But it began with finding a really good agent that represents this sort of work. And then she found a publisher and a specific editor that she sent it to at HarperCollins that she thought that it was just her cup of tea, and she was right.
Now, there are a lot of people who talk about different stages in their lives, big milestones. For example, you know, getting married. You know, there's all this lead up to it, and then you get married, you have your wedding, and a lot of people say, like, the next day was sort of like it was before. It's just sort of a continuation. This is one of those milestones that every author dreams of. Do you feel different as a writer, like when you go back to a keyboard? Do you feel bolstered by it, or is it just sort of like, let's tell another great story?
It feels great, like, all the time. Like, I feel like I haven't come down. Starting with when I got an agent, and then when she delivered the news, which was July 15th of last summer, when she, you know, called me and I rolled out of bed to her call from New York, and then later in the day when she had it firmed down between, you know, she got HarperCollins to make the specific offer, that, like, I felt high from that ever since, and it feels... I feel really lucky and fortunate, and I sometimes I just can't believe, when the book became available, even though you can order it, it won't be delivered until January, and the cover should be shown online. I know what the cover looks like, and I've shared it on social media, but you can order it. And I did, just so that I could click purchase and not then wake up from a dream. So it feels really great. It certainly, my wife used to, like, catch me working on a novel in the middle of the day at a coffee house and say, aren't you supposed to be working? And I'd be like, this is work. And now if she sees me doing that, she has to say, that better be a novel that you're writing. That better be something marketable or something with an audience, not one of those
that
crazy
better
ones
be that, a novel you're writing.
Right. It feels really, I feel really lucky. If I were comparing it to a train, it's a train that I just hope that I can stay on and keep on riding and have, you know, I feel like I've got lots of books in me, and I just hope that I can continue to find a large, wide audience for what I write.
Nice use of metaphor.
Thank you. It was unavoidable.
So at the same time that this has been going on, your family has been encountering a pretty big challenge. Do you mind talking with us a bit about that?
Yeah, not at all. So back in February, our 7-year-old daughter, Harmony, her front teeth started to be pushed out, like she was getting a very sudden and dramatic overbite. And we had just gotten braces for our 12-year-old, so I was just thinking, like, oh, that's going to be another expensive fix, since I had just paid for our 12-year-old Ellery's braces, but when we took her to the orthodontist sent us to a dentist, and then an oral surgeon, and then an ENT, and then she ended up being admitted into Phoenix Children's Hospital, which has been great. She was there for 9 nights or 9 days, and she has rhabdomyosarcoma, which is like a 4 kids in a million get kind of cancer, and that's what was the tumor that was pushing her teeth forward. So the prescription was for 12 weeks of chemo to reduce the size of the tumor, and then they did surgery. They had to take out four front teeth, which were unfortunately the grown-up teeth already, and then a chunk of the roof of her mouth. Happily, it did not have to go all the way through to her sinus cavity, and then they built what's called an obturator, which is sort of like a thick retainer with 4 false teeth attached to it. And now she's coming up on week 6 of another 12 weeks of chemo that is somewhat less tough on the body than the first 12 weeks were, although it's been tough enough. Like, she's spent the last 2 nights she had to go to the ER because of her temperature. It's like the protocol, if their temperature is a certain level, then they have to go in. So the last 2 nights, and so in the last 6 days she was in the hospital 4 days, 3 times at the ER for the temperature and 1 day for chemo. And then before that, we were in San Diego for 3 days. And then before that, she was in the hospital for 3 days because of high fever. So she feels better than you or I would if we had a fever of 102 or 103.
Right.
But it stinks. And I feel very sad for her to have to go through everything that she's gone through, but she's done it. Her ability to find the happiness in whatever happiness can be found in a moment, and her resilience and her strength has really been an inspiration to the rest of our family and to other, you know, friends and other members of the community, and who have been incredibly supportive. We feel really lucky to be connected to the people that we're connected to that have lifted us in a way that we could not have imagined going into it. People talk about the gift of cancer, and when I had heard that previously, I felt like that's just Pollyanna nonsense, but I totally get it now because of the, for us, what it's been is a demonstration of the beauty that humanity is capable of, or, you know, one aspect of it. So,
well, I was going to say, what's extraordinary about this time period, it seems, is that on the one hand, you have this incredible high, this high note about the book and all the success, and you're finally, you know, you've just discovered this this incredible thing with the book coming out, and then on the other hand, you have this very difficult family challenge, and you've had to struggle watching Harmony through it. How have you? What kind of support system have you discovered through it?
Well, I guess the first of all, people that have been through it, it was interesting. Friends that are cancer survivors themselves knew, could sense what the news that we eventually broke before we had, in a way that was sort of spooky. They could just tell what we were going to say before we said it. All sorts of, I think one of the most moving things was a girl who, somebody that was unknown to us, who was a friend of a friend, who sent a card. I think this girl is 8 years old today, and she had a much more difficult cancer when she was four. She had radiation every day and chemo every day for like months. And I saw a picture of her on her last day of chemo. She looked terrible and was grinning and holding up a sign that you sometimes see on Facebook that said, "This is my last day of chemo." Those pictures have always been like difficult to look at because, when they're hairless, no eyebrows, no eyelashes, and they're just look like they're coming out of a concentration camp and just look like the picture of sickness, but smiling because it's their last day of chemo. So this little girl who went through that 4 years ago wrote a letter to to Harmony that included the words, something to the effect of, "This is going to be very hard, but you can do hard things," and which to me was incredibly moving and contained just an immense amount of wisdom. And I completely ripped that line off for the novel that I wrapped up about a month ago, which is about a 12-year-old girl whose little sister is diagnosed with cancer. So my hope is that book, which is called Echo's Sister, will be the second book of my contract. It has to be middle grade, so it needed to be from the point of view of the big sister. And while it's not the story of Harmony and Ellery, my girls, it's very much informed by what we've been going through. And it was very... it helped me process what we were going through. I actually on the podcast of Amy Silverman being interviewed about her daughter, and she's the editor of the New Times, processing what her daughter's diagnosis like a news story, and that felt really familiar because of when this happened to Harmony, the way that I sort of processed it like a story, and at first it was playing in my head like a novel, and I was trying to push it away because it felt, I don't ordinarily write about things that are very much like my life, and it felt too spooky to write about something so close to me, but ultimately I felt like, as I believe that, when the muse gives you an assignment, you just say, "Thank you, muse," and get to work on it instead of trying to argue with the muse about whether it's a suitable idea.
That is a fact.
Yeah. So, and I'm glad that I did. It was, I think it's, people of the people that have read it so far, which don't include my editor, who has not read it yet, but, have responded well to it. So I hope that it becomes the second book.
Well, this is why I was curious whether there was some cross-pollination between your actual daughters and a character like Ryder. I'm assuming they've read all these books, right? And the manuscripts as they develop.
Harmony has read part of... Harmony has not read Train I Ride, and she's on the young side for it. She's a smart reader, but she's read part of the first book that I wrote for younger readers, which is called Story Girl, which is... it's got some heavy-heartedness to it, but it's mainly... It's more silly. And Train I Ride is a little bit more heavy-hearted. And then Echo Sister... I don't want Harmony to read because although I know that there's part of her that knows what she's up against and she, you know, she gets, the fierceness of the foe that she's battling, I think that it's a little too explicit, or at least it's more explicit than we're, the terms that we're trying to keep things, make the horizon nearer, like, you know, this is what we got to do tomorrow. This is what we got to do this week. This is, you know, you have to drink this nasty medicine before you go to bed. And because there's so many of those kinds of things. And just to try to keep her from to drawing attention to, you know, that's part of our trying to stay positive and in the moment, which has worked really well for her. But Ellery has read everything, my 12-year-old. And I think that she found it satisfying that the Echo Sister was through the point of view of somebody such as herself, and I think for my sake it was useful to have another reason to consider what my older daughter was going through because it's a different kind of tough feel like you're getting less attention. Feeling guilty for being aware that you're getting less attention, also being worried about the health of your little sister, all, you know, so she's sort of has a set of worries that are unlike anybody else's worries. So and writing that book helped me consider, you know, have my mind on those worries.
Well, this is always kind of the age-old question about being a responsible adult and also a very honest writer, no matter what type of writer you are, whether it's nonfiction or fiction or poetry, that you're probably going to reveal something uncomfortable about what you actually think and feel. I'm guessing that one day Harmony will read this book. Because it's something her father wrote. This is something I struggle with myself now that I have a 2-year-old, and you know, everything I write, I kind of think in the future, like, well, when he's 16 and discovers this, like, what is he going to think, and when am I going to reveal it? Do you? I mean, she knows that you're writing it. Do you know when, like, at what stage you think she might be ready to encounter it?
That's a good question. I tried to entice her into reading it. We were at Scottsdale Fashion Square to do something, and I was trying to write the book that I'm working on now, and she was done drawing. She was drawing something, and then the only book that I had on hand was Echo's Sister, this like proof copy that I had published, and I tried to get her to read the first chapter, which the little sister does not even appear in, but she knew what the book is about, and she seemed really reluctant to read it. So I think that it's sort of, she herself seems to be viewing it sort of like Pandora's box. Mm. And I felt like the first chapter would be safe for her because it's kind of silly until the 12-year-old, you know, comes down the steps of her school and sees her dad standing there and says, what? And then, and that's the end of the chapter. So I feel like hopefully it's, she'll read it in a couple of years' time when she's more like in the sweet spot for the age that it's intended for, and it has a clean bill of health, and so that it will be less scary to look you know, head on at, you know, the reality of what she's going through, because not every kid in the book makes it, but the And not every kid in her situation does. So she's got a good prognosis. But so that's the, I guess, long answer to a short question.
Do you think they'll be interested in writing too?
They already do it a lot. They're really good. I think that maybe kids, you know, by a certain age, you either internalize story with a capital S or you do not. And I think that they both have.
Well, hopefully the legacy will continue. Paul Mosher, thank you so much for coming on to KBOX Heart of the Arts.
Thanks so much for having me, Robert. It's really an honor to be here. All right, so this is the from the opening of the novel Train I Ride, which again is out January 24th of 2017.
The train I ride is 16 coaches long. It's got a locomotive, which doesn't look like the ones in books or movies, and some coaches where the rich people sleep on beds, and coaches where everyone else sleeps on seats. And it has a dining car, and a car with windows all around and on the ceiling, where happy people on vacations dream about good things that await them. And girls whose lives have been torn apart sit and stare miserably at the countryside rolling past. I was living in Palm Springs, California, because Grandma lived there. She was the one who got stuck taking care of me. Palm Springs is a place in the middle of an empty desert with gigantic mountains above it. It's so hot in the summer, I felt like I'd go up in a poof of smoke, and way up in the mountains above, the snowy peaks would look down at me and laugh. They are mostly old, retired people, and nothing to do except play bingo and golf. Grandma lived in what was pretty much the armpit of Palm Springs. Some days I hated it with all my heart. But in spite of it not being such a wonderful place, and Grandma not being the warmest or most entertaining person around, I wasn't happy to leave it behind. It was what I knew, for 2 years anyway. It was comfortably dreadful. And now I'm rolling away from it because Grandma can't take care of me anymore. The train station in Palm Springs is by a highway overpass. It isn't so much a train station as a bus stop with train tracks and there's sand everywhere. I got on early in the morning with my one big suitcase they checked and my one bag I carried, and the one smallish box that is surprisingly heavy for its size. The sheriff or deputy or whatever tipped his hat to me and handed me over to Dorothea. I'm almost 13, but I supposedly need to be watched over by people since I'm traveling alone, and watching over me is Dorothea's job. Dorothea works for Amtrak, which is the name of the train. She's as wide as she is short, and I can tell she's a real stickler for the rules. But she's not all bad. She gives me a tour of the train, including where I'll sit next to her on one of the passenger coaches, in the observation lounge upstairs and the bathrooms downstairs. 16 coaches long, she says, counting the locomotives and the luggage car and everything else. You're lucky to have a seat on the second level. You'll have the best view. Dorothea smiles a lot and asks me how I'm doing and if I need anything. I don't think she can really get me anything, but she asks anyway, which may or may not be nice. I haven't made up my mind about that. I have to sit next to her all the way to Los Angeles. I sit at the window and look at everything we pass. We go past 1,000 windmills that spin like crazy giants waving their arms, and ugly transmission lines carrying the electricity all the way to Los Angeles. We go through the gap in the big mountains where every day cool fog from the Pacific Ocean meets hot air from the desert and fights with it over which direction the wind will blow. Then down into the basin of Los Angeles, where I'd never been, because Grandma couldn't drive anymore and told me it wasn't worth seeing anyway. She was wrong. I see homeless people living in cardboard boxes alongside the tracks, sleeping in the morning sun, the noise of the train I ride thundering by. They have beat-up couches and recliner chairs facing the tracks. The graffiti on the walls of the businesses and warehouses alongside is their decoration, but more alive than the copies of paintings people buy at the mall, put in their living rooms, and show their friends when they have parties and serve cheese fondue, like Grandma's neighbors Les and Ray used to make. Lots of things that are worth seeing aren't happy things. That's how I see it, anyway. Grandma doesn't have to see those things anymore. But I do.